Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency. All right, so with that official disclaimer out of the way, let's get right into our deep dive today.
Yeah, and I'll jump right in and give you the operational bottom line up front. The proliferation of ultra-cheap, asymmetric drone technology is rapidly outpacing traditional air defense architectures globally, from Eastern Europe to the U.S. homeland. Meanwhile, peer adversaries are adapting, with China rehearsing complex ballistic missile strikes in the desert, and Iran leveraging post-conflict vacuums to control maritime choke points. Ultimately, the traditional paradigms of military superiority are being completely rewritten by commercially available technology and bureaucratic maneuvering.
Wow. Okay, so that is a lot to unpack. And our mission today is really to connect the dots on all of that, because we're looking at a stack of incredibly diverse sources. We've got, you know, Al Jazeera reporting on the Middle East and Eastern Europe. We've got deep updates from the Institute for the Study of War, and some really heavy analysis from Lawfare.
Right, and the connective tissue here is just vulnerability. I mean, major global powers are finding themselves paralyzed by cheap tech.
Yeah. I mean, let's start with something visceral, because this isn't just happening on foreign battlefields. Imagine you're standing on a beach in Southern California, right?
Okay.
It's a clear day. Just 15 miles off the coast, there is this rusted, unassuming fishing trawler just bobbing in the water. Nothing looks out of the ordinary at all.
But it's not just a fishing boat.
Exactly. Because in less than 10 minutes, a piece of technology launched from that boat, something that costs a fraction of a used car, by the way, could paralyze three of LA County's major oil refineries. No massive radar warning, no fleet of stealth bombers.
Yeah, just cheap, off-the-shelf tech, quietly slipping past, you know, billions of dollars of national defense infrastructure. And that exact scenario was highlighted in the Lawfare piece. They discussed a recent FBI warning sent to state law enforcement about a potential Iranian plot.
Using the Shahid drones, right?
Right. Using Shahids launched from offshore vessels against California refineries. Now, the sources do note that this specific intelligence was unverified.
So it wasn't an actual plot in motion?
Well, no concrete evidence of one. Mm-hmm. But the terrifying part is just the sheer plausibility of the mechanics. I mean, the physics of the threat are what caused the alarm.
Because they're fast.
Yeah. A Shahid drone travels at roughly 115 miles per hour. If you launch it from just outside territorial waters, it reaches coastal targets in single-digit minutes.
Wow.
And more importantly, it flies way below the curvature of the Earth. Our domestic air defense was built to spot incoming intercontinental ballistic missiles, you know, not something the size of a moped skimming just above the waves.
Right. But the Lawfare analysis makes it clear that the Shahid drones are almost the lesser concern compared to the sheer volume of those smaller drones.
For first-person view drones, yeah. FPV kamikazes.
Yeah, the FPVs. I mean, the numbers here are just staggering. Ukraine produced 4 million of these in 2025. And their target for 2026 is 7 million.
7 million.
Wait, explain the manufacturing behind that to me. Because you don't just churn out 7 million weapons from a few traditional military factories without them becoming massive, obvious targets for airstrikes. How are they physically doing this?
Well, they're doing it by completely abandoning the traditional factory model. It's the absolute definition of decentralized manufacturing.
So like spreading it out.
Yeah, we are talking about hundreds of nondescript office buildings, basements, and garages. The operators use banks of commercial 3D printers to just print the chassis.
Just standard 3D printers.
Exactly. And then they buy standard commercially available drone motors, batteries, flight controllers, literally the exact same dual-use components a hobbyist would buy to build a racing drone.
Oh, wow. So they just ship these parts in through totally normal civilian logistics chains.
Right, which makes it practically impossible for an adversary to embargo the supply. It's only at the very final stage, hidden away in some basement, that they strap an explosive charge to it.
Transforming a toy into a guided missile.
Exactly. And that dual-use nature makes the supply chain unstoppable, which leads to this really chilling comparison in the Lawfare piece.
Right. They talk about the threat of these cheap FPV drones falling into the hands of terror groups like ISIS or Hezbollah.
Yeah.
And they compare the potential public panic to The 2002 Washington, D.C. sniper attacks.
The psychological parallels there are really striking. I mean, during those 3 weeks in 2002, two guys in a highly mobile blue sedan managed to paralyze the entire D.C. metropolitan area.
People were terrified to just pump gas.
Or walk across a parking lot. Because the threat was invisible, random, and could strike from a distance without warning, law enforcement was basically chasing a ghost.
So now put yourself in that scenario today, but amplify the tech. Imagine you are sitting in a packed college football stadium, and a terror group decides to use kamikaze FPV drones.
The pilots wouldn't even need a line of sight.
No, they could be sitting in an apartment 3 miles away, just looking through VR goggles.
Yeah.
And if you're thinking, well, surely law enforcement can spot a rogue drone, the sources point out how monumental of a challenge that is.
It's a massive challenge. The FAA says there are over 837,000 registered drones in the U.S.
In Los Angeles County alone, there are over 12,000. So how does a police officer at a stadium separate the signal from the noise? How do you look up at the sky and distinguish a hobbyist taking panoramic photos from a lethal threat?
Especially when you only have seconds to react.
Exactly.
And the reality is, law enforcement practically can't make that distinction visually. Historically, the defense against this was never visual anyway. It was electronic.
Right. Radio jamming.
Yeah. You flood the area with radio frequency noise to sever the communication link between the drone and the pilot's controller. The drone loses its signal and either drops out of the sky or just automatically returns to launch.
Except the technology has already sprinted way past that defense. I mean, relying on electronic radio jamming now feels like trying to stop a flood with a chain link fence.
That's a great way to put it.
Because Lawfare mentions drones are bypassing radio signals entirely now. They're being tethered to their controllers using spools of ultra-thin fiber optic cable.
Which is wild. We are talking about a physical glass thread that can stretch up to 20 kilometers, just unspooling from the drone as it flies.
20 kilometers of cable.
Yeah. And Hezbollah is already deploying this technique in Lebanon. Because the command inputs are traveling as light through a physical glass tether, there is zero radio frequency emitted.
So there's literally nothing in the airwaves to jam.
Nothing at all.
And if they don't want to use a physical tether, they are shifting to AI.
Yeah.
Fully autonomous AI-driven navigation. So the drone is launched, and it uses onboard visual recognition software to match the terrain to a map, find its target, and strike. No human pilot.
Which removes the human from the loop entirely during the terminal phase of the flight. An AI-driven drone doesn't need to phone home for instructions, so again, jamming is completely useless.
Our primary defense strategy is just becoming obsolete. And if we want to see what happens when that chain link fence fails against this flood of drones, we just have to look at Russia right now.
Yeah, the updates from Al Jazeera and the ISW paint a picture of a superpower just bleeding from a thousand tiny cuts.
Because Ukraine's long-range drone strikes are hitting incredibly deep inside Russian territory. They hit the Kapotnya oil refinery right inside Moscow. They hit gas plants in Orenburg, which is over 1,200 kilometers away.
And factories in Yekaterinburg, which is over 1,800 kilometers from the border. The psychological concept of a safe rear in a war zone is just gone.
And the economic toll is compounding too, right?
Well, absolutely. The sources detail instances of literal oil rains falling on neighborhoods in Moscow after refinery explosions.
Oil rains?
Yeah, and it's causing severe gasoline shortages to the point where Russian authorities actually had to lift travel permits for fuel tankers in Moscow just to keep basic supply chains moving.
Wow.
We're seeing rolling power outages in occupied Crimea too. The Kiel Institute refers to this whole broader phenomenon as structural exhaustion.
Which sounds like academic jargon, but the reality is just brutal. It means the underlying machinery of a nation isn't just taking a hit, it's breaking down faster than it can be repaired.
Yeah.
It's the logistical nightmare of trying to reroute domestic fuel supplies across the largest landmass on Earth because your refineries keep exploding.
Right. And that exhaustion ripples outward to geopolitical alliances. Take Belarus, for example.
Oh, yeah. The ISW reporting on that was fascinating.
Yeah. It notes that following a direct ultimatum from Ukrainian President Zelensky, Belarus disabled signal repeaters on its border with Ukraine.
And those repeaters were critical infrastructure, right?
Yeah.
They allowed Russian forces to bounce radio signals and fly their own guided drones deep into Western Ukraine.
Exactly. So by turning them right off, Belarus demonstrated how desperate Russia's allies are to walk a tightrope. They're trying to avoid being dragged fully into the crosshairs of this tech.
And the human cost in the occupied territories is staggering as well. The ISW updates mention that historic Crimean summer camps, like the Artek camp, are being forced to close due to the intensifying strikes.
Which raises deep fears that Ukrainian children currently at those camps will just be deported deeper into Russian territory.
But then there's the sociocultural conditioning happening. Mm. The Russian Orthodox Church is actively integrating military training with spirituality for Ukrainian youth. Mm. Like, they are combining morning prayer services with military prep. They even launched a Crimean drone league.
Right, a racing competition for kids.
Okay, hold on. I have to push back on this. They are mixing morning prayers with kamikaze drone racing for kids. How does that even work culturally? Is this a sign of sheer demographic desperation, or is it long-term strategic indoctrination?
It is a really profound attempt at generational indoctrination. By gamifying warfare through drone racing and then wrapping it in religious and civic duty, they're attempting to normalize the militarization of daily life for these children.
Building a pipeline of future operators.
Exactly. Because this war increasingly relies on thumb skills and screen tracking rather than physical infantry endurance.
Which brings up a massive contradiction to me. If your country is facing severe structural exhaustion, your refineries are burning, and you're resorting to gamifying warfare for children to fill your future ranks, mm-hmm. why are Putin's peace demands so incredibly high?
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive.
Because according to the Al Jazeera report, Moscow's stated position for peace talks requires a return to the 2022 Istanbul agreements. They demand the demilitarization of Ukraine. They demand that Kiev formally recognize Crimea as part of Russia. And they insist on the denazification of the Ukrainian government.
Which is Moscow's stated characterization of the current administration in Kiev.
Right. But if you are taking all these hits at home, why put forward terms that you know the other side will immediately reject? Are these negotiations just a smokescreen to buy time?
Observers cited in the reporting assess that, yes, this is a classic smokescreen. Presenting maximalist demands allows Moscow to claim to its domestic audience that it's open to diplomacy while knowingly stalling.
Ah, so they use the delay to try and stabilize the fuel crises.
Stabilize the fuel crises, adapt their supply lines to the drone threat, and really just wait to see if Western political support for Ukraine fractures. It's a strategic pause disguised as a negotiation.
So, the Russian model is currently proving that traditional superpower armor is incredibly vulnerable to cheap, asymmetric tech. And other global powers are watching this, and they're adapting.
Right. They're not sitting still.
China, for instance, seems to think the answer lies in hyper-advanced AI-driven missiles. Lawfare published this fascinating analysis on satellite imagery coming out of the Taklamakan Desert in Xinjiang.
Yeah, China is taking a highly centralized, top-down approach to future conflicts. The satellite imagery reveals that Beijing is literally constructing full-scale mock-ups of U.S. warships out in the sand.
Full-scale.
Yeah, they have precise two-scale outlines of Arleigh Burke-class destroyers and the USS Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier.
But these are not just static shapes painted on the ground, right?
No, they've built six-meter-wide rail systems underneath them, outfitting the mock-ups with radar reflectors so they can simulate massive ships actually moving at speed.
And the whole purpose of this incredibly elaborate desert theater is to perfect the kill chain for their anti-ship ballistic missiles, the DF-21D and DF-26.
Right, the kill chain.
Which is the sequence of events needed to successfully destroy a target. You have to find the ship, track it, launch the missile, provide mid-course updates as it flies, and finally execute terminal guidance where the missile's own seeker locks onto the target.
Exactly.
Sort of like a quarterback throwing a deep pass.
Mm-hmm.
The mid-course guidance is the quarterback throwing the ball to the spot down the field where the receiver should be. But the terminal guidance is the receiver looking up, finding the ball in the air, and adjusting the route at the last second to catch it.
That analogy perfectly captures the mechanics of the bottleneck China is trying to solve. Because when an anti-ship ballistic missile re-enters the atmosphere at Mach 2, the seeker in the nose of the missile only activates at an altitude of about 3 to 5 kilometers.
That's practically right on top of the target.
Yeah, it gives the missile's computer a remarkably narrow window, just mere seconds, to scan the ocean, recognize the specific shape of an aircraft carrier amidst the radar clutter of waves and other ships, lock on, and adjust its trajectory to strike.
So the desert provides a perfectly controlled laboratory. This is an incredible aha moment for me, actually. China isn't just building a target range. They're trying to solve a dynamic software problem, AI visual recognition, using a static hardware environment.
Exactly. Out in the Taklamakan Desert, there is no commercial shipping traffic to confuse the sensors. There's no bad weather.
There's no electronic jamming from an adversary.
Right. It allows their engineers to repeatedly drop missiles and test if the software actually recognizes the shape of the carrier as it falls from the sky. They can run that final critical phase of the kill chain over and over again in a sterile vacuum, feeding the data back into their AI models to make the seekers smarter.
But it sounds like an NFL team running complex offensive plays in an empty climate-controlled stadium to perfect the timing.
Yeah.
But here's my question. How does mastering a missile strike on a rail track in a quiet desert actually translate to hitting a heavily defended maneuvering carrier group in the chaotic, jamming-heavy environment of the Pacific Ocean?
Well, that disparity is the central vulnerability in China's strategy. If the mid-course tracking data provided to the missile is even slightly stale because the U.S. carrier group maneuvered unexpectedly.
Or the electronic warfare environment blinds the sensors.
Right. Then the seeker turns on at 5 kilometers high and sees nothing but empty ocean. So China is proving they can engineer a solution to the sterile half of the problem in the sand. Executing the chaotic half of the problem at sea remains totally unproven.
Wow. Okay, so China is rehearsing for an ocean conflict decades away, but right now global powers are being squeezed by bureaucratic maneuvering in narrow waterways today.
Yeah, geography still dictates the economy.
Let's look at the Al Jazeera and ISW reporting on the Strait of Hormuz. Because while technology is changing the weapons, this fragile post-conflict negotiation is determining who controls one of the most vital waterways on Earth.
Right. To set the context, this vital choke point was severely disrupted during a period of U.S.-Israel hostilities with Iran. Currently, there is a fragile 60-day memorandum of understanding and MOU in place to halt the fighting and reopen the strait to commercial shipping while broader talks happen.
And this matters to everyone listening because roughly 20 million barrels of oil transit the Strait of Hormuz every single day. That is a fifth of the world's global oil supply.
It's massive.
When a choke point like that freezes, the ripple effects hit your wallet at the gas pump almost immediately. But even with this 60-day agreement, the situation is incredibly volatile. I mean, Oman and the International Maritime Organization established a new centralized shipping route to get traffic flowing safely again.
But Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, is completely rejecting that route.
They are issuing direct warnings that commercial vessels must only use routes explicitly approved by Tehran.
And those Iranian-approved routes naturally pass much closer to the Iranian coastline. Iran claims the Omani route was announced without their coordination and poses safety risks due to uncleared naval mines.
But fundamentally, this is a maneuver to maintain physical proximity and absolute leverage over the shipping lanes, isn't it?
Absolutely. And then there's the looming threat of the fees.
Right.
The agreement states that Iran will waive transit fees for 60 days to allow for these demining operations. But the heavy implication, as noted by observers, is that once those 60 days expire, Iran might introduce mandatory transit fees.
Perhaps rebranding them as environmental or security tolls for safe passage. Okay, I have to interject with a critical observation regarding the Strait of Hormuz here.
Go for it.
If 20 million barrels of oil transit this strait daily, and Iran starts unilaterally charging environmental or security fees, isn't that just state-sponsored piracy rebranded with bureaucratic paperwork?
Well, legal scholars and international diplomats would validate that exact assessment. Under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, vessels have the right of transit passage through international straits. It is a foundational pillar of global trade.
And U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has stated firmly that the Strait of Hormuz cannot be tolled, right?
Exactly. He warned that if ships are threatened or if traffic stops because of these unilateral demands, it'll be considered a direct violation of the MOU. Because if a state successfully imposes tolls under the guise of security, it erodes centuries of established norms regarding the freedom of navigation.
It's an absolute powder keg. So how do you defuse a situation where one country holds the global economy hostage over a strip of water?
The ISW reporting highlights regional diplomatic efforts trying to find an alternative off-ramp. Qatar and Saudi Arabia are attempting to facilitate broader economic frameworks and reconciliation summits between the Gulf states and Iran.
Trying to integrate them.
Right. The goal is to integrate Iran into the regional economy deeply enough that they have a vested interest in keeping the strait open, rather than seeing it solely as a tool for extortion.
Makes sense.
And additionally, the broader post-conflict management extends beyond just the water. I mean, briefly looking at southern Lebanon, we are seeing discussions between the U.S. and Israel regarding a pilot program for the Lebanese Armed Forces, the LAF.
To backfill the IDF, right?
Yeah. The plan involves U.S.-trained LAF personnel stepping into positions vacated by the IDF to monitor ceasefire violations and prevent a resurgence of hostilities. It's a really delicate, multifaceted effort to build a new regional architecture.
Wow. Okay, so when you take a step back and synthesize this massive stack of sources today, what is the unifying thread for you?
We are watching the global landscape being structurally reshaped simultaneously from the bottom up and from the top down. From the bottom up, you have incredibly cheap, decentralized FPV drones paralyzing traditional militaries and threatening the fundamental security of urban centers everywhere.
Yeah.
And from the top down, you have superpowers like China relying on hyper-advanced AI to rehearse massive carrier strikes, while regional powers test the limits of international maritime law to control economic choke points. The systems that kept the world relatively stable, radio jamming, traditional factory logistics, freedom of navigation laws, they are all failing stress tests at the exact same time.
And for you listening, this is exactly why diving into these sources matters. Because the geopolitical tectonic plates are shifting and the tremors reach you directly. The concept of a distant war happening over there is over.
It really is.
It's the price of gas determined by bureaucratic piracy in the Strait of Hormuz. Or it's the future of public safety at your local events due to unjammable drones. The technology has brought the front line right to the horizon.
It demands a total rethink of our defensive postures, our legal frameworks, and our civic infrastructure. The old rules simply no longer apply.
Which leaves us with a really chilling concept to mull over on your own. We discussed how fiber optic cables and autonomous AI are making drones unjammable.
Right.
But if these signalless autonomous kamikaze drones become standard for both global warfare and domestic terrorism, how does a society adapt to protect its public spaces when the skies are filled with machines that literally cannot be reasoned with, jammed, or remotely shut down?
That is the defining question we have to answer.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Stay alert out there.